Good morning again. I am so glad to be back. I know there are a lot of people away, I think there's families in Hawaii right now. Can you believe that? So yeah, the Wilsons and Monroes are, you know, they're in the hula service today, I think, probably. So, we're glad you're here. And if you're a guest with us, welcome, welcome, welcome. We're so glad you're here. We're honored that you're here. And we hope that you'll make yourself at home. We want you to know you're always, always welcome. And we're so thankful that you're here. I hope you got a bulletin. This kind of tells some of the activities happening throughout the week, as well as a little cheat sheet there, a little listening guide, as we call it. Going along with the message. So again, if you're a guest, welcome. We're so delighted you're here. And I'd love to know that you're a guest here. There's a little slip that attaches to the bulletin. It just zips right off and it says welcome because you are. And I'd love to know about you being a guest with us today. Those come to me. So anyway, I'd love to know about that. So thank you so much for coming. And thank you to LaVon. Thank you to Jason for filling in. Jason, I know I already have heard, you know, just a wonderful, passionate message about relationship. And, you know, we at Hillside, that is a priority. Our relationship with the Lord Jesus Christ and our relationship with each other. Those two things is what we're all about. And that's what Christ said, you know, when he was asked, what's the greatest commandment? Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. Jesus wasn't even asked about the second one. He was only asked about the first one. Isn't that interesting? It's like that's how we live our love for God many times is with each other. So so I am so thankful for that. And thank you to LaVon for leading worship last week. I appreciate that so much. To let some of you know, those of you part of the Hillside family, we have got things posted out there looking for somebody to come and to do worship. And so we're praying about that and looking at that. And so we hope you'll pray along with us. So, you know, so I don't have to keep switching hats, you know, and you guys hear enough of me to have to do it all. So anyway, but I appreciate your patience with that. Be praying, those of you part of the Hillside family, as we seek God's direction on that. We're in the middle of a series called Christian. I know, really original title there. And we've been talking about the fact that, in fact, right there in the introduction in your notes there, there's some things I just want us to use as a reminder. So some of you say, well, this is my first Sunday in this series. I'm going to give you a capsulization of some of the stuff of what we've been talking about. And we've been really launching off of this idea. Some of these ideas are not well known. For example, you know, the truth of it is, and this is probably most people, if you think about it long enough, know this, is that, you know, you can call yourself a Christian and you can kind of just about believe just about anything you want or do just about anything you want. That sounds terrible, but you and I both know, we know Christians, people will say, I'm a Christian, and that their life doesn't really reflect it, and even some of their beliefs don't as well. The second statement, too, is that, you know, the fact is that the Bible doesn't even tell us what a Christian is. Isn't that interesting? Nowhere. I mean, we call ourselves that. I call myself, people say, what are you? I'm a Christian, you know? In fact, if they ask me, what kind of church do you pastor? I say, I pastor a non-denominational Christian church, you know? And so it's like, wow, okay. Another word, interesting thing is the word Christian was actually a derogatory term. It wasn't a complimentary term, but it was a derogatory term used in the first century to describe Jesus' followers, those who were Christ's followers. But it's not a term, next, is that they used for themselves. They didn't call themselves Christians. We have derogatory terms now, you know, in these days, of course, for years of, you know, derogatory terms. You know, we talk about not being politically correct. You know, we don't use derogatory terms. This would be a very politically incorrect thing to say. This would be insulting. And then Jesus, though, gave his followers a very narrow and at the same time a very technical term. And that was what? The word disciples. That's what Jesus called. Jesus' followers were called disciples. Not just the 12. There were others as well. If you were a Christ follower, you called yourself and you were in a group of disciples. And that's why, because this word Christian is used so loosely, that's why almost in every single issue, it could be political, it could be financial, it could be some kind of family thing, it could be international issues, even war. There are people who would call themselves Christians on both sides of many, many issues. You find them because you can't really define it by the Bible. You can say, well, a Christian means this. You can't describe a Christian. You can kind of describe any way you want. But when you open up the New Testament and you look at the Bible and ask the question, what does it look like to be a follower of Jesus? It's terrifyingly clear. It's frighteningly clear. In fact, here's what he said to his closest followers just prior to him leaving. And we've looked at this verse a couple of times before. Jesus says, if you don't get anything else, followers of mine, if you don't get anything else, here's the trait that should describe you. This is the characteristic that should characterize you more than anything else. He says this in John 13:37. By this, everyone will know that you are my disciples. There's the term, disciples. If you love one another. They're not going to know by your cross jewelry, they're not going to know because you got that wild t-shirt, that says Jesus died for me or whatever. It's not what you do on Sunday morning. That's not the way, it's not your bumper sticker. It's not what kind of family you were born into. It's not even that you've gone through some rituals. It's not even that you take communion. It's not even that you have gotten baptized. That's not how you're going to show people that you are my follower. He said, here's how they're going to know. How do you treat each other? How do you love one another? Then in the same conversation, Jesus says, and let me tell you how I want you to love one another. This is where I think he takes it to a whole nother level. He says, I want you to love each other the way I loved you. Now, that's the problem. That's a difficult thing. First of all, we know Jesus is perfect. But also, it's a problem because all of us think we know something about love, and we do, and we do. And all of us think we've experienced love to some extent, and we have. And all of us think we've experienced love, and we know love, and yet Jesus said, okay, people are going to know that you're my followers by the way you love each other, and I want you to love each other the way I loved you. And that's here's just the problem that we open up with. We go Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and look all the way to Jesus' love. And in some ways, it's like his call to follow him. It's a bit terrifying. It seems inconsistent. When we look at the way Jesus loved, there is a tension there. And we're going to see that, and it's going to become more clearly in just a few minutes. It's a tension we all, to some extent, want to resolve. In fact, it's a tension that we're so uncomfortable with that many of us went to churches that were kind of at one end of the spectrum or the other. Others of us may have grown up in churches, one side or another side. And regardless of where you went to church, it's not that you didn't believe what was taught. Not that you didn't believe what was taught was true, but you just thought there's something missing. Something missing. I went to a college that way. I mean, they were a far, far, far pendulum swing to one side. And it was always that feeling. You can hear this theologically, go, well, yeah, that's right. That's Bible, right? But it's like, wow, something is really, really missing here. They're telling me the truth, but there's something huge that's missing. And so, And regardless of where you went to church, it's not that you didn't believe, again. It's just that you felt like something's not there. And the reason is because perhaps there was. Because when you open the New Testament and ask the question, how did Jesus love? You might think of acts that he did. You might think of specific times when he showed love. But if you take all of that together, here's some startling, characteristics of Jesus' love. Number one, it was messy. It was messy. Another thing that it seems like Jesus' love was inconsistent. At times, we just say, wait, hang on. It's unfair. And even to the point when we look at all of the incidences of Jesus showing his love, it can be confusing. Because there's this tension, and our temptation is to resolve that tension. And if you don't hear anything else today, hear this. If you try to resolve the tension that's created around Jesus's love, you lose. And you give up something very, very important. In case you still feel like you're not tracking, you will. You'll understand this very, very clearly. And yet we are tempted. We're tempted to do that all the time. We're tempted to emphasize one kind of thing or another. There's that temptation to resolve that. Now, let me just say this. As your pastor, and some of you are guests, so I'm not your pastor yet, right? I'd love to be. But as a church, we try the best to the best of our ability to hang on to that tension. But at times, it gets messy. At other times, it seems inconsistent. And at times, it seems to be unfair. And sometimes, it seems confusing. And when I get those emails, and I get those letters, and I get those comments, and those, you know, face-to-faces where it's like, wait, that seems wrong. That seems inconsistent. That seems unfair. I kind of try to comfort myself in realizing, maybe we got it, you know? Maybe we got it, you know? You know, and even in preaching, yo, it's not, I'm not getting fed, it's not deep enough, whatever. And then on the other side, oh, but you know, we need to relate more to people, we need to evangelize. You go, wait. See, that's a tension. You don't want to lose that tension. That's a good tension to have, see? I see it sometimes. In fact, you know, I have some gay friends who, particularly one guy that was talking to me, and he was saying, he says, you know, I used to go to a church that was predominantly a gay church. And he said, I didn't like it. He says, because when I went there, he said, it was predominantly catering to me being a gay person. And he says, you really didn't hear anything about the Bible. So he left that church. Now, he says, it's very uncomfortable. I walk into churches and I don't know if I'm going to be accepted. I don't know if I'm going to be welcome. I don't know, you know, how I'm going to be received. But, you know, it's okay because I want to hear what the Bible teaches. And yes, sometimes the pastor makes me feel horrible. But that's okay. See? Tension there. Even though it's scary. The other time where I really sense this in our congregation is those difficult times when I have to open up scripture and I have to talk about what Jesus says about divorce and remarriage. And it's horrible, you know? I mean, for those of you who've gone through a divorce and all of that, it's kind of like having a root canal with no Novocaine, you know what I mean? It's like, and if you're, you know, if you're here and you've experienced that, it's just, it's brutal. And I don't tell you when, you know, we're going to talk about it because I know none of you would show up. So, because it feels so condemning, and yet it's interesting because even though it feels condemning, I get this response, man, David, that was a hard message. That was agonizing, and I'm so glad we were here for that. We had some conversations, and we had, you know, or I was on the brink of divorce, and oh, man, you know what? It was helpful. It felt condemning, and yet I gained insight into why we struggle sometimes the way we do in our marriage or whatever, and I felt so condemned, but it's okay. It's okay. Can I continue to serve in the church? Yes, of course, right? There's that tension. Whenever we open up the scriptures, we take seriously the teaching of Jesus. There's this tension. At times, we look at him, and he seems so forgiving. And then at other times, he seems to hold everybody accountable. At times, Jesus seems really harsh. And then at other times, he's kind. There's times when he's pointing out sin, and then there's other times when it almost feels like he's ignoring sin completely. I was talking to a group of pastors, and I don't do this as much because I typically announce this, but when pastors, especially those maybe going through books of the Bible, whenever they talk about sex, they said they always announce it. They said because the next week they always have a high attendance. You know, they say it for some reason. You know, you feel that tension. People hear those messages and always wonder. And sometimes when you know that I'm going to talk about or deal with something like that with sex or sexuality, you know, sometimes I wonder, what do people think I'm going to say? You know, good news, found the fifth gospel, and it says, love the one you're with. You know, what do they think? It's, you know, some kind of new insight. What do you think I'm going to say? People say, and I've had people say, in fact, remember our guardrail series? During that series, I had more people come and say, man, that was hard, but boy, I'm glad I was here. I did not like that message, but boy, I needed that. See the tension? See, there's that tension. You know, David, I hated that message. Can I get a copy of that for my kids? Right? Right? And we live that way. We live in that tension, and that's okay. And here's the deal. Personally and individually, we're all tempted to want to resolve that tension, but if we give up that tension, we sacrifice something very, very important. It's what drove people crazy about Jesus. He just wasn't predictable. And Jesus was very comfortable with it. And he was able to minister through it. And we dare not walk away from it. I mean, even though, oh my goodness, it's messy. It's really messy. At times we seem to be inconsistent. Again, at times we seem to be confusing. At times it seems like, you know, it's unfair. And it leaves people thinking, you know, what are they really about? What do they really believe? Now, John, who wrote the Gospel of John, one of the Gospels, we have Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And he wrote John. He also wrote some letters later on to the churches. And we've talked about this before. But John was a follower of Jesus, and he got to be an old man. Now, that wasn't the truth for all the disciples. Matthew, we think, was burned at the stake pretty early. The Apostle Paul was probably beheaded from what we read in history. Peter, history tells us Peter was crucified. History even tells us he was crucified upside down because he thought it was too much of an honor to be crucified right side up the way Jesus was. All the followers of Jesus, they scattered and eventually became martyrs from the best that we can tell. Some of them just disappeared and we into antiquity. But John, we know, was a survivor. And he grew to be an old man. And 40, maybe 45 years after the events of Jesus, it became evident that Jesus wasn't returning. You remember when he left, Jesus, you know, told them, hey, I'm going to come back. So they're all, you know, pulling out their calendar. Okay, what, a week from Thursday? Or when are you coming back? You know, or sometime next month, you know? And they're waiting. And they're anticipating. And he doesn't come back. And they may all have still have been confused by a conversation that Jesus had with Peter and John. The disciples were there. John records this at the end of his gospel, the very, very end. And I want to just read that to you and have you follow along. John 21, very, very end of the book of John. And what had happened was Jesus had just told Peter that he was going to be a martyr for him. Verse 20 says, Peter turned and saw that the disciples whom Jesus loved, and John's not being proud, by the way, when he just, he obviously just felt so loved by the Lord. This wasn't a cocky thing like, hey, I'm the one that Jesus loves. He felt so overwhelmed by God's love, by Christ's love for him. He distinguishes himself that way. So Peter turned and saw that the disciple whom Jesus loved was following them. This was the one who had leaned back against Jesus at the supper and had said, Lord, who is going to betray you? When Peter saw him, he asked, Lord, what about this man? In other words, you just told me that I'm going to die, but what about this guy, John? What's going to happen to him? See, Jesus foretelling that Peter would die for Jesus. So Peter asked about John, and Jesus answered, verse 22, Jesus answered, if I want him to remain alive until I return, what is that to you? You must follow me. And then because of this, the rumor spread among the believers that this disciple, John, would not die. But Jesus didn't say that he would not die. He only said, if I want him to remain alive until I return, what is that to you? Verse 24, this is the disciple who testifies to these things and who wrote them down. We know that his testimony is true. Jesus did many other things as well. If every one of them were written down, I suppose that even the whole world would not have room for the books that would be written. Many scholars, by the way, this is a little sideline. Many scholars think that verse 24 or maybe 24 and 25 were added by followers of Jesus that were there the time John wrote this. But one thing we know, Jesus didn't show up. And John didn't live until Jesus came back. We're still waiting for that ourselves, aren't we? Years go by, and finally, probably somebody said, look, John, we love that you're teaching. We love these stories you're telling us about your interaction with Jesus. We love all of this. This is great, and we're benefited from it and so forth. But in case Jesus doesn't come back during your lifetime, I think it would be really good for you to write some of this stuff down. So as an old man, God leads, by the Holy Spirit, leads John to write what we call the Gospel of John. And he has all these memories and stories of what he's been through. I mean, he's seen death. He's seen sorrow. He's seen bloodshed. And led by the Spirit of God, he sits down and he begins to write his gospel. And he begins his account of the life of Jesus with this grand, wonderful picture of Jesus being like a word. And that word sent from God. That God sent his word, Jesus, into the word, to the world, and that word became flesh. And he was human, and he walked with us, and he ate with us. And John paints this wonderful picture that he gives to us. It's as if Jesus has painted a painting full of people, and then he went into the painting to interact with all of the people. But the people in the painting didn't recognize him as the artist, and they threw him out. How powerful is that picture? And how powerful is it? And we try to describe the conflict that he sensed among the people that Jesus came to love. Then in the opening section of that incredible record that we have there in John, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, he gives us the terminology, he gives us the words that best capture that tension that we've just been talking about. That if you're a follower of Jesus, you're going to bump into it some point or another. If you're a follower of Christ, it becomes messy, it becomes inconsistent, it seems hard, and you know if you go one way or the other, you're going to leave something out. And that's in verse 14. And here are the words that he left with us. He said this. Look at John 1:14 there. The word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. And there's this great imagery there with those three words. Look at that. Made his dwelling among us. It has the idea that Jesus camped out with us. He moved in with us. Jesus lived with us. And when John says us, by the way, he's not just talking about us 2,000 years later. Because we always want to put ourselves in there. Us. Oh, that's us. He's talking about really physically, like me and the guys, you know, John sent me and the guys, he made his dwelling among us, literally, you know, we. And he's not talking about you and I, we. He's not talking about us, we. He's talking about them, we. John and you know, the disciples, the buddies there. And he's talking about himself. He and all the disciples, the guys that followed Jesus, they ate and they lived with him and they talked with him. He said he was literally right here with us. He's saying, we have seen, and I've seen something you haven't seen, he's saying. And that's why he's passing along. He's writing this down. I've seen something that you had to be there to really get. I saw something. I wish I could have captured it so that you could see it as well. We have seen. He says, we have seen his glory. The glory of the one and only Son who came from the Father. And then he gives us our two words. Full of grace and truth. Full to the brim of grace and truth. And there's that tension. We know what grace is. I mean, people, we describe that, you know, unmerited favor. We know what grace is, and we know what truth is. See, truth says you're accountable. Grace says, oh, but you're forgiven. Grace says you're valuable. And truth says you're broken. Grace says you're okay. And truth says you've got a lot of work to do. Grace says, no matter what, I love you. And truth says, yeah, but you're still accountable. See that tension? There's that tension, and all of us in our personalities tend to lean in one direction or the other, don't we? Some of you were brought up with parents, and one of them was Gracie, and one of them was not so grace-filled, right? Mr. and Mrs. Ungrace, and one parent was about truth, and your parents would argue behind closed doors, or maybe not behind closed doors. They'd argue about, you know, how we're supposed to raise this and whatever, and how about, you know, you are supposed to have all these this tension was there, you know. And let me guess, you liked the grace one, right? I did too, of course, you know. But let me say this, if you grew up in a great home, you got a good dose of both grace and truth. And here's what John said. This is so, so remarkable. John said, I spent years watching Jesus navigate the intricacies of some very difficult circumstances. And as I begin my gospel, I begin my description of what it's like to be with Jesus, and here's what he saw. He saw that Jesus was absolutely full of both grace and truth. He wasn't one or the other. We want to try and divide it. But Jesus was completely full to the very, very brim and flowing over with both grace and truth. We want to separate it. If we were to use this illustration to illustrate ourselves, we'd have a divider, and we have a grace side and we have a truth side. Jesus, the Bible said, was full of grace and truth. And that's why the confusion sometimes. The mode that they, you know, again, I want to be one or the other. I want to push Jesus in one direction or the other. I like the verses. When it has to do with other people, I like the verses that lean toward the truth, right? When you get into those theological arguments with people, or you talk to somebody, maybe from another religion, and what do? You pull out the truth stuff. But of course, when it comes to me, I want you to use the grace stuff. I like the grace stuff for me. Truth for you, grace for me. See, it seems fair. You right? You feel the same way. And John watched Jesus, and the best way he could describe it is he said Jesus was full of grace. He was full of truth. It's kind of like one of those theological discussions. Was Jesus all man, or was Jesus all God? And the answer is yes. Was he full of grace? Yes. Was he full of truth? Yes. That doesn't seem like mathematically possible, but the truth is he was full of both. And we said this, look in verse 16. Out of his fullness, we have all received grace in place of grace already given, which literally means we've all received grace upon grace upon grace upon grace. Oh, you're full of grace? Oh, got a lot of grace there? Okay, good. We're going to give you some more. We're piling it up. Grace upon grace. You know, he poured the picture of grace and it overflowed. We've all received grace upon grace upon grace. And then to bring us to a point of clarification, he says then in verse 17, for the law... Now, what was the law? That was the Ten Commandments. That was the 613 other commandments that were related in the Old Testament. For the law was given, and this is important, for the law was given through Moses. So, you know, we all saw the movie, right? Moses there comes down, he's got the Ten Commandments. And then the other laws all happened too. The law was given through Moses. The law that told us, here's what God expects us to do. So don't do this, and really don't do this. And thou shalt not, right? Thou shalt not, thou shalt not, thou shalt not. Really, 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 really shalt not. All those. And if thou doest, thou shalt, you must go to the temple. You got to do a sacrifice and get atonement for your sins. All of those laws. He said the law was given to us through Moses. And then, here's the huge distinction. I think maybe John had to pause as he was writing to kind of figure this out. And of course, God was leading him. You know, how do I put this on paper? He says, grace and truth came. And he doesn't use the word given. He uses a different term. Grace and truth came. The word there is the word that it's translated came into being. It was born. Okay? It showed up as a full package. Grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. Not, again, here's an important distinction. I want you to see this, and I put this in your notes because I didn't want you to miss it. This is not the balance of grace and truth. That's where we want to live. It's the full measure of grace and truth. See? Not the balance between grace and truth. It's the full measure of that. Okay? Let me say it another way. In fact, even pointing to Jesus here in John 1. It's not the balance between grace and truth. It's the full embodiment, see, of grace and truth. This is what made Jesus so messy. I'm comfortable with that term, but you understand what I'm saying? This is what made it so confusing, and in some ways made him very unpredictable. It's because everybody wants to lean one way or the other. You know, those of you who know me best know I'm a grace person, you know, right? Some of you, and I frustrate you. He needs to be firmer, and he needs to, oh, right, because you're a truth person, right? God's saying, following Jesus means being frustrating to people because you're full of grace, you're full of truth, and we're trying to follow the best we can, Jesus. And John says, you know, he was all of it. He brought all of it to bear on every individual he talked to. He brought all of it to bear into every situation. And just when we thought he was going to go one way, what happened? He was grace and truth in a body. And if we begin to read the Gospels again through the lens, you see it. One day, Jesus shows up at the well. And some of you, if you grew up in Sunday school, you probably heard this story, but he's at a well, and there's a Samaritan woman comes out, and he's all alone with the Samaritan woman, and Jews didn't even talk to Samaritans, let alone a Samaritan woman. And he talks to her, again, which you're not supposed to do. What is that? There's grace. She's like, man, why is he even talking to me? You're a Jew, and I'm a Samaritan, you know? And he says, hey, you know what? I'm thirsty. I'd like some water. Would you use your jar and lower and get me some water? And she's so amazed that he's even talking to her. Then just when things are going well, he says, hey, I want you to go back to Sychar. That's the town she lived in. Go back to Sychar and get your husband and bring him out. You know, I'd like to meet him. And she says, well, I have no husband. He says, I know you don't. Then he reaches into the most painful, the most shameful part of her life. And he says, truth is, you've had 5 husbands. And the man you're living with now, you're not even married to him. And even Samaritans know that, you just don't do that. And you've had 5 husbands, and you've either divorced them or they died. But either way, you've done a terrible job as a woman with men, and you're not good with men. That's very obvious. And inside we go, Jesus, you don't say that. I mean, didn't you go to seminary or anything, you know, take a class on counseling? You don't just go right for the jugular right there, you know. You take some time, right? What are you thinking? Don't just say that. I mean, I thought this was grace, right? Here we seemed like he started off pretty graceful, and now, boom. And then Jesus reveals to this woman something we don't find him revealing to anyone else up to this point in the Gospels. He looks at her in the eyes, out alone by this well, and he says, guess who I am? I am the Messiah. I haven't told anybody this, but I've chosen you, a Samaritan woman, eyeball to eyeball. You are looking into the face of the Messiah. And he said, then further, and I can give you water in your life and in your soul, and it'll satisfy you like no man ever could. She goes in the town, she's telling everybody, and she's, you know, no, she probably has no credibility with anybody in the town, but she's back in the town going, you know, I've met the long-awaited Messiah of God. You've heard me talk about Jesus' interaction with Matthew, the tax collector. Everybody hated Matthew. Everybody hated tax collectors. I mean, you don't like him much now. Back then, you would have really hated them. Because they were traitors. They were Jewish traitors. They were completely religious and political traitors. And they were thieves as well. And in the New Testament, they had categories. In fact, you'll hear that term, tax collectors and sinners. Tax collectors were so bad, they didn't even put them in the same category as sinners. I mean, everybody, you know, any rotten person could get in the category as a sinner. But you had to work pretty hard to get in the category as a tax collector. And they would even make that distinction. And Jesus says to Matthew, he's there collecting taxes. And he goes, I want you to join my group and follow me. To which the disciples, you know, reading between the lines, you see them thinking, wait, what? You're inviting him to do that? Hey, Jesus, if we let a tax collector into our group, people are going to think that we approve of tax collecting. I mean, aren't you afraid, Jesus, that, you know, your reputation is going to be on the line? I mean, you're letting this tax collector come in. We all know that they're evil. We all know that they're wicked. We know that they're Jewish traitors. Are you going to, by letting them in, do you think that they're going to, maybe people are going to think that maybe you approve of tax collecting? Do we really want them into our group? To which Jesus would have said, oh, guys, it's going to get a lot worse than that. I mean, we're not just letting him follow us in the group. We're going to his house. And he's going to invite all of his tax collecting friends. And you think your reputation's bad now. Wait till the party starts getting going, you know, by 6 this evening. I mean, it's going to get a lot worse. And the truth of it is, the guys were like, wow, Jesus, your reputation. And Jesus would have said to them, what do you think I came here for? Why do you think I came humbled as a servant? I didn't come to hang around the righteous. I came to save sinners and to bring them to repentance. I'm sure that those, can you imagine the disciples? Okay, good. Okay, yeah, okay, we got to get this. Somebody write this down. We're confused. We've seen the grace. We've seen the truth. We just don't know where they all intersect. Then when Jesus was crucified, he was crucified between two men. And we're told they were thieves, but the Greek shows that they were much, much more than thieves. They didn't crucify thieves. They crucified the worst of the worst. In other words, we're not talking about somebody just did some shoplifting or just a little bit of pickpocketing. That's not the Greek word there. The Greek word uses what really they're talking about is people who were completely immoral plunderers who exploited the vulnerable and weren't afraid of using any kind of violence at all. They didn't care about killing people. They didn't care about hurting people, and they preyed upon the most vulnerable people. These were men who were so bad. Here's how bad these were. They were so bad they couldn't even be trusted to row in a Roman galley. They figured they probably would kill some of the other people in the galley. These men, they were so wicked. They couldn't even be slaves. They couldn't even be kept for life, you know, in mines. That's how wicked these guys were. And Jesus is crucified by two of these guys. And one of them even says, while they're hanging there, we're getting what we deserve. And we'd expect Jesus to say, no, but I love you. Oh, you've got a good heart. You know, I can see. You come from a good family. Jesus is basically, I'm not going to argue with that. Yep, you're up there, and you deserve it. But here's what he said. He didn't argue with them that they were deserved to be up there, but to the one who said that, he said, but when you breathe your last breath today, you and I are going to be in the same place. Today, you are going to be with me in paradise. Wait. Time out. Few chapters ago, this young, ambitious guy comes and he says to you, I want to have eternal life. And remember what you told him, Jesus? You said, well, sell everything you have and give up your life and come and follow me. You know? And here's this violent robber who's got like 1 minute on the clock, and you're letting him in. You know, what's he going to do? Rededicate his life? He's only got 20 minutes, you know. It's like, what's there to lose? And yet, he gets to be with you in paradise? I mean, think of us disciples. We left everything. You said, come follow you, and we've been doing everything you said, and we've been sacrificing. We've come in situations where we thought we might have been killed, and we've had to give up everything and follow you, and he gets in at the last minute? There's no point even doing that from a cross. It's, you know, what's he giving up? From now on, I'm going to follow you, Jesus. He can't even move. And yet, this day, you'll be with me in paradise. The best of the best, the perfect with the worst, they'll be together in paradise. See that? You see the tension? You see it. I can see in your face you see it. It's like, what do we do with that? I'm telling you, if you try to resolve it, you lose something. And then maybe the most famous story of all that finds its way into this tension is the woman who was caught in adultery. It's such a strange story because they bring her to Jesus and they say, Jesus, according to the law, and remember, the law is given through Moses, according to the law, she should be put to death, she should be stoned. What could Jesus have said? He could have said a lot of things. In fact, he could have said, hey, according to the Roman law, you can't put her to death. That was true. So get out of here. Don't try to trick me. You can't put her to death, so, you know, just go away. But instead he says, okay, let's play to the law of Moses. Stoner. And what I'd like this to begin this with a person who doesn't have any sin. Go ahead and stone. You start this whole thing. The person with no sin, you start. The person who's never committed adultery in their heart. The person who's never been tempted. The person who's never lusted in their heart. You go ahead and you throw the first stone. The person that thinks, oh, I would never do that. You go ahead and you throw the first stone. And when all of a sudden the law of Moses and the law of retribution begins to break down, they all go away. Jesus makes everybody uncomfortable, doesn't he? And he looks at this woman and he says, and watch this. He goes, I don't condemn you. Go and leave your life of sin. Wait. Which one is it? It's like, I don't condemn you or you're a sinner? Yes. I don't condemn you. Now go leave your life of sin. Did you have to bring up that sin part? God always has to bring up that sin part, right? We were going along so well, enjoying our wonderful time, and then he brings up the sin part. Well, then how can you say she's not condemned? And Jesus would say, go and leave your life of sin. Yes, you're a sinner. You're not condemned. That doesn't seem to make sense until Jesus says, that's the way I love. That's how I love. This is how I love. I'm the embodiment of grace and truth, Jesus said. We could go on and on. We could pull a lot of stories. But as a church, I just want to say this again. I so want to get this right. And we don't always get it right. But when we find ourselves in these difficult situations and we say, God, we're not going to just be truth. We're not just going to be a truth church. That would be so easy. And by the way, as a pastor, you know, as a preacher, that's what you're prone to do. Like, I don't care how you feel. I don't care what you're doing. I'm just going to get and tell you the truth. And that's, you know, you go home and feel guilty. And I could do that. I could make you feel guilty. I mean, there's just a few things. We as pastors, we can make you feel guilty every week if I wanted to, you know. Or I could come in because I'm a pretty good talker. And you're a long talker. But some of you would just say, I could encourage you and exhort you and make you feel good, you know, right? I could do that. And then some weeks you say, wow, he made me feel really good and sometimes made me feel really bad and sometimes I feel really bad and then I got made to feel good. What is all this? And I'm trying my best. And you go home and you say, I don't know. I don't know what he said. He says something in the Greek and the Hebrew and I don't know. And I'm not going to just focus on the truth part. I like that because it's principles, you know, number one, two, three, four. Or exhortation. Let's all hold hands, sing kumbaya. But when it's me in trouble, see, I like the grace part. And when, you know, I'm up here, it's okay, all the truth part. So we're conflicted. I want to love like Jesus loved. I want to minister like Jesus ministers. And if you want to know what Jesus meant by what Jesus said, you watch what Jesus did. And in loving, if you want to know what Jesus meant when Jesus said to love one another as we've loved him, then you watch how Jesus loved. Do you know how he loved? He loves like he's loved us. What does that look like? And this is true of all of us. What does he do? Jesus calls sin, sin, and then he pays for it. He called sin, sin, and then he paid for it. And having paid for it, he declared, I don't condemn you. Then he says to all of us, now that I've called sin, sin, paid for it, and said, I don't condemn you, I want you all to leave your life of sin. And if you don't leave your life of sin, I love you. If you can't, I love you. And if the woundedness and the shrapnel of your own sin just has left you in a place where you're not even sure you'll be able to wake up the next day, I love you. And if someone has sinned against you and it has sent you into a spiral of self-destructive behavior, so much that you're not sure you'll ever be able to recover from it, I love you. And the truth is, you're a sinner, but the grace is, I don't condemn you. And no one will ever love you more, Jesus would say, no one will ever love you more than I love you. That's what Jesus would say to all of us. And that's the tension there. Do you know why we can't let go of truth? This is going to be a really deep statement, but we can't let go of truth because sin has a gotcha. You know what I mean? Sin has a gotcha. God doesn't want it to get us. So every once in a while, in fact, not every once in a while, constantly, he says, here's what's true. Here's how you've got to live. Here's how you've got to treat people. Here's what you have to do with your morality. Here's what you need to do in your ethics. And here's how you need to be honest. And here's why you shouldn't cheat. And here's why you can't steal. And here's why you have to confess. And right? And here's why, you know, you have to be accountable. Truth side. Sin has a gotcha. And I don't want it to get you. And the reason you have to, and you can't let go of grace is because to some extent, sin has already got us. It's already got us. And grace is our only way back. Grace is our only way home. Grace is the only way that we'll know we've connected, that we've reconnected with our Heavenly Father. And so we need truth. And we need grace. And if Jesus was the embodiment of grace and truth, and if the church, capital C, church is his body, you know, and we're a reflection of that, we're a church. If Jesus was the embodiment of grace and truth, and we're his body, we're his hands, we're his feet, we're the best expression of Jesus anybody will ever know, then we have to be comfortable with the mess, with the unfairness, with the inconsistency, with the stuff that goes through with managing that tension, grace and truth. And again, I 24th year here, started last, you know, a couple months ago. After many years of doing this, many years of trying to do this right, and after many conversations where I've hurt people's feelings, and I've leaned too far one way and not too far the other, or in some cases too far one way and not enough the other, you know, you just cycle around and reestablish and realize that here's what I'm convinced of, that the church is at its best when it embraces grace and truth and refuses to let go of either. Wouldn't you love, don't you want that to be the characteristic? Tell me about Hillside. Hillside is, they'll tell you the truth and they'll love you. Tell me about Jesus. He died for you. He paid for it. He knows your sin. He knows you're wrong. He knows, like the woman at the well, he knows you've had five husbands and the one you're with isn't your husband. He knows all the yuck, yuck, yuck. And he doesn't condemn us. Why? Because he paid for it. He paid for it. If you want to know what Jesus meant when Jesus said to love one another, there it is. It's messy. It's difficult. And we just don't know what to do when that tension at times, but we dare not let go of either one. Let's bow.